This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Brother, do you know Kevin Kincaid from Crossing Broad?
I do not know him, no.
Yeah, he just put some...
Well, I know who he is.
Kevin Kincaid. I don't even know who that is. Anyway.
It's always soccer in Philadelphia on a victory Thursday. It was not a victory, actually. It was a draw. It was a 2-2 draw. It was an aggregate victory. 3-2 Philadelphia Union over Atlas FC. And, for a team that needed 10 years to win their first playoff game, the fact that we are sitting here talking about the Philadelphia Union knocking a Liga MX team out of the Champions League is quite the turn of events that I did not predict when we started this podcast in 2016. And I can confirm probably as well that Joe Tanzi, who joins me on the show today, did not see this coming 7 years ago either. Is that an accurate take, Joe? And how are you?
I'm good. Does this count as the first Union post-game show of the season by anybody?
I guess, yeah. Well, true, yeah.
Sorry, yes. I'm trying to not be petty about that, but yeah.
No, it's all good. It's all good. We have been, another topic for another time, but it would have would have been nice to talk about that after, in the immediacy of the final whistle going as trash was thrown down onto the field and the chant was coming from the stands and all hell was about to break loose before the ref finally called it right around midnight. But, I got to be honest, I have no rundown here. I just got off the phone with somebody else. I'm flying by the seat of my pants, but I want to start macro. And it's just that they knocked off a Mexican team in the Champions League. They're to the semifinals for the second time in 3 years. And that's an accomplishment, man. I mean, like it should not be lost on anybody, regardless of what expectations are for this year, that getting to the semifinals of the CONCACAF Champions League is a big fucking deal, as Joe Biden once said to Barack Obama. And I guess that's my entry point here is like, let's at least just try to realize the massiveness of the moment, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Right. And we can finally put to bed the poor performances elsewhere this season, because the one caveat hanging over this team was, well, they're playing like garbage, but if they make the Champions League semifinals, all is forgiven. And it feels nice to be talking about that, because, we've seen it how many times with MLS teams in Mexico where that early goal goes in and they just crumble. Absolutely just fall to pieces. It's a tale as old as time. And luckily, the Union were able to battle back. It wasn't a perfect performance, but it was a very gritty, hard-nosed performance, and it showed a lot of resiliency. And from the bigger level, I mean, two Champions League semifinals in 3 years, you get to try and enact some revenge off of LAFC, which is always a fun storyline now. It really is remarkable. I mean, even just the back to the Ernie Stewart era, where things were just trying to kind of come together, and you were hoping that maybe one CONCACAF Champions League berth was going to be a big deal. And now we're talking about two CCL semifinals in 3 years, an MLS Cup berth, Eastern Conference champions, a supporter shield. I mean, it really is astonishing how much success they've had in such a short span.
But it was gritty and like a test of metal in a different way, because right. I think like normally we would have all been under the guise of or under the thought that like, hey, they're going to have to go out down there and like defend like hell and batten down the hatches and bunker and like kind of play for a nil-nil or something. Like I didn't expect them to have to be tested in the sense of like going and getting the goal and then right. going and getting the second goal. And so that showed me a lot because, I mean, this is a team that couldn't score at home against Kansas City, needed a penalty to score against Atlas at home in the first. I mean, there's no indication going down there that they were going to even score in Mexico at all, let alone score twice. So that was the most impressive thing because the defense was really not that great last night. But the fact that they went out and they found an equalizer after giving up the first and then they found the second goal to kill it off, that's what said it for me. I mean, obviously, I just was not expecting the game to play out that way at all.
No, and I think it also is a credit to kind of what these guys have been working through. I mean, Mikel Ua, I mean, talk about a guy who's just been drugged through the mud about his performances so far this season. And to go back to they concede an early goal, they could have crumbled. He could have crumbled after the Wondolowski that he pulled in the in the first half.
Did we actually get they showed the replay of that once. Did we, are we like convinced that it came off his shin, or do we think that the other guy got a touch on it? Cause when I watched it the first time, it didn't look like totally clear to me. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there, I'm thinking, like, if he fluffed that, I mean, that's a fluff of a lifetime. Because then Atlas comes down and scores on the other end.
Yeah, I think – I thought initially that the defender got a touch on it because they were claiming for a corner kick.
They were all calling for it. Yeah, it wasn't just him like, embarrassment saying, like, oh, it went off of him. Like, I saw Carranza calling it too, yeah?
Yeah, but the replay, I guess the final touch went off his boot. So, you can make the case if you're that close and you make contact. And even a few minutes before the second goal, he makes that run that just drags the defender right into Carranza's space.
Oh, God, yeah.
So, like, it to me, it speaks to, like, that last goal they had with Ua creating it and playing the assist, and Leon Flock, who we all know doesn't have the offensive skill set that anybody in that midfield has, for him to hustle and then play that ball – I mean, that kind of just speaks to, like, these guys are gritting it out regardless of what they've been doing in MLS play. And also, Julian Carranza, I mean, that price tag is going to be absurdly high.
Yeah. He's not long for this world. I don't think
very much not.
Yeah. And I'm actually, as we're talking right now, I got my laptop pulled up. We're recording. I'm on the desktop and I've got a laptop here and I got the 10-minute highlight reel going. That's how much shit was going on last night. So I can go in a million different ways, but I think you have to kind of look at the lineup itself and the thought of McGlynn going in, getting the start, and Leon Flock coming off the bench, because I don't know about you, but if you pencil this one, if you look at this one on paper and you're thinking like, oh, you're going to go do the thought is that you're going to have to go down to Mexico. You're going to have to scrap and defend like hell and just like throw your body out there. I mean, common knowledge based on that would have told us that like Leon Flock is the kind of guy for this game, mm-hmm. Go out there and muck it up and get stuck in and rah, rah, and all that, whatever. And so I guess here's the question I'll ask, knowing what we know, because McGlynn got the assist on the first goal and he had an excellent game, really. But I wonder how much of that was Jim thinking like, hey, I'm ready to, unbalance it and like try to go for it a little bit more offensively versus knowing also that Atlas was missing guys, right? And they were missing Lozano in the midfield. Goalkeeper was a different goalkeeper. I think it was the other guy in the midfield too, whose name I can't remember. So I'm just wondering how much of that do you think was Jim thinking, hey, I'm ready to just give Jack the reins versus like, hey, this is a specific like one game kind of thing where I think his inclusion in the starting lineup is going to make a difference.
Yeah, I think we finally reached the point that fans have been calling for over the last year, right? Of that McGlynn Flock balance.
Yeah.
And the faith in Leon Flock, no matter what, in this lineup and the 60th minute sub. I think Jim has finally gotten to the point where, okay, Jack McGlynn can play, whether it's the left side of Diamond or the Christmas tree, and be comfortable with all of his qualities. I think Jim was waiting for the defensive side with McGlynn to catch up to the offensive side. And the first leg, he was really good. with his defending. And I thought he showed well again last night. And I think that's where it's at with Jim now with that selection is it truly is level pegging on across the board. Whereas in the past, it's been Jack's your offensive guy, Leon's your defensive guy. That's how we're going to approach it no matter what. I think Jim's, because he's a defensive-minded guy first, he's finally gotten the defensive trust in McGlynn now. And we all know what he can do offensively. I mean, he hit that assist with his off foot.
His weak foot, yeah. Yeah. Right foot, man. Yeah.
So I think that's where we've finally gotten to the point where this debate that we had all of last year has finally gotten to the point where fans have wanted it to get to.
Yeah.
Because that's what it shows. It shows that Jim has not just trust in McGlynn's offensive abilities, which he's had, but now that he can play defensively and hold his own, and he's become a more complete player. I think that's the reason why he's been able to start these Champions League games. At home, of course, you want to go for it, but to have him defensively to go for it, to rotate the guys like he did in Cincinnati. And then you do have a closer now. You have a few closers on the bench now with Flock. I don't know if Bueno's at that level yet, but he could technically be one. Perea can be that. Damian Lowe can be that. So it kind of speaks to what they've actually been building and saying for these last few years. But the McGlynn thing, I think, is finally at the point now where Jim can put full trust in Jack and really have him be on the field as much as we all want him to see.
Well, and that was then, I think that's probably the question we got more than anything last year between this podcast, between the post-game show, between just generic, fan, writer, / whatever interaction on Twitter, you, me, John, everybody, Sean, everybody, right? I mean, that was the topic. It was like Flock, McGlynn, Flock, McGlynn, Flock, and so on and so forth but the sticking point, I think, on that initially was like, because they weren't scoring goals early on last year. So we kept saying to ourselves, okay, well, how do you get the offense going? And it was like, well, take Flock off, right? And put McGlynn on, right? And so that was kind of the key point of that, because we were sitting here thinking, and then the counter argument to that was like, look, if the catalyst to getting the offense going is to take off one of your freaking shuttlers, then what does that say about the forwards and the number 10, and then the fullbacks, right? But I think they're at a point now where they just don't need, where they're not going to sacrifice a ton of defensive balance. Because I think, it's always a matter of how much does McGlynn's offense, how many, arbitrary percentage points better is McGlynn's offensive contribution versus Flock's defensive contribution. Right. And I think like what we've learned now is that yes, the former means more than the latter, but it also opens up Joe, like this role for Leon off the bench, perhaps, where he comes in and does like the Warren Carvajal kind of thing. Right? Like, yeah. Run around, be crazy, use your energy, leave it all out there for 30 minutes, maybe go grab a loose ball and set up a second goal. So I think that's like probably a pretty good thing for him. And I would just, so number one, your thoughts on that. Number two, I wanted to make this point as well. I think Leon is the best off-ball player that the Union have. I've said that from the beginning. But the Union are not like the high pressing team that they were 3 years ago. So I think if you were in a situation where you were like, you still had Brendan out there, still had Cashmere out there, and you were like really like pushing high up the field, I mean, Leon playing like a number eight, like behind Brendan Aaronson, that would have been a terror for other teams, The Union now are a counter pressing team. They're not like a high pressing team. So I think like Leon's skill set does sometimes get a little bit lost because it's less important in the collective team tactical side of things.
He gets the whole skill set gets lost because there's no real statistics on a shuttler. Like with McGlynn, you can say, oh, here's his assist, here's his chances created, key passes, all that stuff. Whereas with Flock, it's like, well, you can't really quantify passing in this system. You can't quantify possession in this system. And the guys who have more all these defensive stats, like tackles, interceptions, like stuff we try and quantify by, are Martinez, Gleznes, Wagner. So it's very hard sometimes to actually describe how important he is without watching him, because he is a very important part to this team still. But when you have the McGlynn Flock argument, it's like, well, show me what Leon Flock brings, and you really can't do it until you watch him, and it's the work ethic. And I think it also falls under the Bedoya category of hard work. You know, he's going to give
just
you
non-quantifiable effort. Stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Like, right. Yeah. That's always going to be the case. And like, I think it was always, I think it's pretty safe to say, look, I mean, there were some people who were not Leon Flock fans, but I think a lot of it was, I think a lot of the discussion centered less around, it wasn't like a anti Leon Flock thing. It was more of just like a pro Jack McGlynn thing. Really.
It's a pro Jack McGlynn, pro homegrown player. Like,
yes.
Play our guys because he's with the U.S. under 20s. He's doing so well there. So why isn't he on the field every single game? Like that's what it is. And it's totally understandable because we kind of did the same thing with Quinn Sullivan to a lesser extent last year as well. And now he's going through this position change and everything. But like, I think it, you know, Jim says this at least once every month about Leon Flock is that he's still a young player too. I think we all just assumed that they plucked him from what, St. Pauli, and we're like, Hey, this guy's been a professional. He was in Germany. You know, this is his complete skill set. This is what he is, and that's it. Whereas he's what, maybe 2 years older than Jack McGlynn. And he, like, his skill set isn't complete either. So while we're out here lauding Jack McGlynn for his defensive work, you know, Leon has actually made strides offensively. We may not see them. But that was the effort on that second goal is one of those things. So yeah, I think that part gets lost in the sauce too, where like we're so pro Jack McGlynn and we should be, but that also turns into not understanding like, hey, Leon Flock's still developing too. And when Jack McGlynn's not here in say a year and a half, Leon Flock's going to have to be a more complete player because it's, and the same thing is with like the forwards too, is like there are short-term guys here and there are long-term guys here. And it's very clear who the short-term guys are, like McGlynn, Carranza, whereas someone like Uwa, you want to see banging in goals nonstop because you know he's going to be here for the long haul. And same thing with Gazdek. So I think that's the best way to describe that whole situation without going super more in depth about it.
No, it's fair. It's funny too, because I did think originally some of the like left-sided shuttler stuff was going to be predicated based on like whether Kai Wagner was back or not. And you know, obviously now with the benefit of hindsight, obviously, you know, the hamstring was still, well, I don't know if the hamstring was a thing or not, or if it just, you know, he just slipped on the sod father's turf down there in Jalisco. And I don't know, but I guess the point being is like you felt originally, I was like, okay, well, Kai's back there, so I don't give a shit who's in front of it. You feel comfortable with whoever's at the eight because Wagner's going to be back there, of course. But, you know, I think obviously like the big tactical thing from the game was then he's injured. He has to come off. Like, I think we have Jim like kind of nailed down to a T here because I was like, Harriel's going to come on at left back. Mm-hmm. And then the question was really like, how long do you think Bizo can skate on the yellow? You know, and there was some CONCACAF-y bullshit in there too, where he was
there's that one moment, and I don't think I've said this a lot about CONCACAF refs, but the guy in the middle last night was actually pretty good.
He was actually pretty good. You know, it's funny because I was thinking too because, you know, because I came out and said it, I'm like, that last action that Bizo had before he came off, I'm like, oh, that's probably second yellow. He probably should have been off. But there was also a tactical foul that Atlas pulled like 10 minutes before that got no card at all. So at least he was consistent with it, you know, to the point where it benefited both teams, probably the Union more because the guy who didn't get a yellow on the Union side in that particular case was already on a yellow. but I just, you know, Olivier, I don't know. I think the thing with, look, we obviously know that like Jim trusts Harriel more than Matt Real, of course, which is why he keeps playing Harriel on the left side, even though he's a right-footed guy, right? And like my philosophy with fullbacks is like, unless you're Philip Lahm, I don't want a right-footed guy playing left back. you know, because it just limits you so much to what you can do. But I'm like, well, he's probably do Harrell at halftime here. Real will come on, but not right away. And
I don't know if you caught this, but I think the Fox guys last night were talking about Harrell, and I think somewhere in the comments they said that Curtin thinks he's the best 1v1 defender they have.
Which is
a line I think Jim used for Ray Gattis for like every year that Ray was here.
Yeah, who played on the left and the right. So.
Yeah, so yeah. maybe that's what he thinks. He's like, well, forget the whatever footedness on the left or right side. Like, if he can defend 1v1, that's the ultimate kind of tiebreaker there on who.
Yeah, and the game did not call. You know, and listen, like I think. You know, it would have been different if at that point the game required another goal for the Union, which it did not.
Mm-hmm.
I lost my train of thought there, but what I was going to say is like it doesn't, because the complication here now is saying like, okay, well, Harrell comes on. You're going to have to bring somebody on at halftime regardless because of the injury. But I don't know if it would have changed. I don't know if Jim's thoughts would have changed on that, whether they needed a goal or not. Like if they were down 1-0 and they definitely needed to score and get the away goal, and he put a right footed guy over on the left when he had Real there, then I would have thought a little bit more of it and been like, well, you're not going to get anything going forward from Harrell, in the same way that in the first leg of the Atlas series, it's like they weren't even passing him the ball, you know. But that was
you weren't
playing up a man at home, you know. You were like in a situation where you could have afforded to do that, you know what I mean? So.
Yeah, I think that's where Damian Lowe not being fully fit also plays a role, because I would not have been surprised if Jim at some point in the second half decided to go three at the back.
Go to three, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
exactly. It did work really well on Saturday.
Yeah, yeah, no, it did. You're right. I guess I wasn't surprised by any of that. Do you remember? I don't have the box score up in front of me. How when did they take Bizo out? Like, how long did he make it on that yellow?
I think he made it 60 something. It was
okay. Right.
It was midway through the second half.
It felt a lot. For some reason, it felt like an eternity that he was out there. And I was like, oh,
yes,
you know, down on the ground again. But he and Carranza were the only two really like CONCACAFing it. There was, and I mean, to be fair, like Olivier knew he was on a yellow too, so there was an extra layer of bullshit to warrant that, I guess. But there was like the part at the end there where Bedoya could have just dribbled into the corner. I don't know what he was looking at from Matt Real. Like, I think Real was just sitting there saying like, hey, why are you not like running into the corner here? Or maybe it was Harry. Whoever was on that side behind him was like, why the fuck aren't you just running into the corner? But they didn't like they played him in the second half, you know, and they played him throughout the game. Like the Union really did not do a lot of bullshitting, you know. And I know that they got the red card at the end. So for the final 13 minutes, yeah, they're playing 11 versus 10. But even then, they could, you know, Andre Blake could have just hoofed it up the field, heard the chant, and then they could have bunkered down and just tried to play it that way. But they didn't. They, you know, they brought the ball up the field, and you know, they went for the second goal and they got the second goal. But I wanted to ask you, like, when you watched the second goal replay, when Ua put that pass in, did that clip the defender's leg?
I'm not sure.
Because it looked like it bounced to me. I watched it like 100 times. Like, I could not get a clean view of it. Because I was sitting there thinking, I'm like, oh, my God, if he screws this pass up, like, Union Twitter is going to explode, you know? Because they had fluffed the 2v1 going the other way not long before that. But I was like sitting, I'm thinking, holy shit, that barely squirted through. Because the way the ball kind of popped up, it made it look like it looked like he megged the defender, but it may have clipped like a heel through the nutmeg. And I was wondering why it sort of sat up like that.
Am I allowed to say, now that he had the assist on the series clinching goal, that Michael Ua actually had a decent to good game, but the two errors are the big ones we would have remembered?
Well, you can spin it, and I'll allow you to. I'm giving out permissions to my guests here. I will. You can certainly spin it into a like he put himself in great positions kind of thing. He had the. God, I'm gonna try to remember them all off the top of my head. He had the one where he kind of got by the defender after the ball got hung up, but he didn't square it back. Still latched onto a ball. You know, he had the other one where he botched the run, but he was there. the other where the offside, the ball was offside, but they ran onto it anyway, and he was going to be there for a tap in. It was like a yard offside if it had taken place. I mean, he it's the type of game where he could have scored zero goals, which he did, or he could have scored five.
I think the Mikael Uwe conundrum is, why don't you score goals? And yeah. I think if you compare it to the last striker who was streaky here, when Kasper Schmeichel wasn't scoring goals, he also wasn't doing a damn thing to do anything to set up goals. Like, it was just straight up laziness. Whereas like Uwe, like, yes, the goals still need to come. You're a designated player forward. They have to come in. You have to contribute to goals. That is your job at the end of the day. But every time I watch him, he still finds himself in the right positions. And that maybe, at least from like my view, taking, you know, not being a fan and like emotionally committed to it, maybe that's where I differ from everyone's viewpoint, where I still see him doing all the right things. Like, he's in spots, he's on the ball, he's being physical with defenders, which I thought him and Carranza did a fantastic job of last night. They were getting on the inside shoulder and drawing fouls and doing exactly what they should do in that environment. So maybe that's just me being a little too lenient with Uwe. And I get it. If you want to say striker, go score goals, I understand that argument. But I watch him and what he does and compare him to the other strikers of previous seasons before he got here. And it's night and day with how he moves off the ball, and he's able to put himself in those spots where, he had a really bad miss, if we're going to call it that, if it's a miss or deflection, whatever, should have finished there, and he interrupted Carranza's run, but he still didn't stop making those plays.
It's like, no, and Schmeichel, towards the end of it, or not towards the end of it, but I mean in that 1 year specifically, I mean, because in his first year, he would do some hold-up play. He would come out and he would peel wide. He would, like, get up on the ball and kind of, like, do some things to help out his teammates. But, yeah, I mean, Schmeichel, towards the middle-slash-end part of his Union tenure, was like, you're ready to rip your fucking hair out. And, like, you have the tweet saved in drafts ready to say how much you can't stand watching him. And then he would pop up with, like, a 84th-minute goal or something, you know? But that was literally the only thing he would do, is just score the one goal. And then the other 89 minutes of the game, he would do nothing, right?
And that's why the Chicago Fire are still looking for a striker.
Well, yeah. So Uwe, you know, to his credit, yes, he is still running and still moving. And, like, the movement between the front three last year when they were scoring all those goals was fantastic, you know? So it's not for a lack of trying, right? I mean, I will give you that. I mean, I understand where you're coming from, and I think that's a valid kind of thing. I just didn't understand some of those, like some of the runs he was making, like on the one that you were talking about where he starts to come inside. First of all, Carranza should have played Uwe on the left a lot earlier, right? And open up the channel and move that defender. Then he's got a 1-2 coming back for you. So I don't know why Carranza held onto that ball in the first place. I don't know why Uwe came back around him. And third, I'm not even convinced that wasn't a penalty, because because Carranza got clattered into at the top of the box there, and the ball was kind of away from him a little bit. But the ref in the first series, that's where they got the denial of a goal scoring. It was the same clattered into sideways from behind thing.
Yeah, there have been certain instances, and this is just the whole season as a whole with the front three is, I mean, there was an instance in the first half where Uwe's on the right side of the box, and all he has to do is just put the ball somewhere in the center, and he's got an open Carranza, an open Gazdag. It feels like there's been a lot of those moments where they're not being selfish or unselfish in the right spots. Like, it feels like that last decision just isn't clicking like it was last year. Like, they're finding themselves in the spots. They're making the runs. They're still working like hell defensively, but it's that. And it's been so hard to quantify, and it really just comes down to, like, eye test. I'm like, what are you seeing compared to last season between those three? And I think that's – last night kind of showed that too, is, like, they have the right ideas. They know how to play with each other. But when the decision-making just isn't there and you know, that's early season stuff, whatever it may be. But, like, it's that play. Like, yeah, Carranza could have played the ball out to Uwe, and Uwe doesn't even make that run around and drag the defender into Carranza. It's just very, like, it's not quantifiable stuff. It's stuff you got to see from watching this team from last year and this year, where I think it's just the decision-making between all three of them is just where they should make the final pass.
It's just not where it was. Just not where it was last year. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's nothing that you can really put a finger on unless you're, like, watching all the games like we are and just saying, like, you know, something's just up with the eye test here, like their decision-making, their runs and whatnot. I'm watching back the – you know, this doesn't exactly help on a non-visual medium, but I watched that play like five times in a row again just now. And my only thought is that, like, he was thinking he could, like, kind of slide, do this, like, loopy kind of, like move to get behind Carranza, and Carranza could just sort of, like, leave it out there for him, which would have been a really good angle for a shot. But, I mean, even then, it was a lot to ask because there's two guys chasing, you know, in addition to the – it was like a 2v1, but two guys were kind of right behind him, so – he had Gazdag coming down to the left, but he was kind of out of it. I don't, you know, the one thing that I started doing is in lieu of, you know, taking notes for the shows now, I just kind of look back through my, like, rambling Twitter page from the night before and, like, kind of, like, kind
I do that when I write, and I was like, well, what happened before what sequence? And I just go through and, like, okay, that's where my head was at those.
Yeah. I don't, you know, and we don't need to get too deep into this. It's kind of like gets in the weeds. It's hard to illustrate on a podcast, but I didn't think the center backs were that amazing last night. You know, at least for like for decent stretches of the game, you know, that first goal was an abortion of, maybe I shouldn't say that word. It was a bad goal to give up. And I don't know, you know, Roe versus Wade. Yeah. I'm trying to be sensitive here. So
I think there's a few guys to – I think that is the classic case of we're going to draw at the center back. We think we know what Baizo's weaknesses are, and I think they did that to perfection. Because I think Baizo still has those moments where it happens once or twice a game where he gets – where somebody gets dragged out or he gets out of position. Like, it's still an incomplete product with him. And that's
he kind of gets sucked like sucked up, kind of pushed out. I don't know if they had some kind of you know, strategic like thought to, like, hey, if like Quiñones is like on your side and he's kind of hovering, like get up and get on his back, like don't give him that space in the hole. I'm trying to watch it back again actually as we're speaking here. Of course, you don't have the full replay from. They've got a 10-minute highlight reel here, and this one's cut short or whatever. I don't know why they cut him like this, but, like, yeah, he got kind of pushed up. Julio Furch actually does a really, really good job kind of running into the corner, and Jack Elliott passes him off to Glesnes. So because Mbaizo gets pushed up, Glesnes has to then go wide where he doesn't want to be. Like, center backs don't want to go over there.
Right.
You know, we don't want to go out to the touchline, right? Because it's just we don't want to defend in space. It's not like our – thing, you know, like, we're not Ray Gattis, right? Right, you know, like, we're just more comfortable banging with dudes in closed quarters or heading the ball out of there. I don't want to be facing a guy. I don't want a guy facing up at me dribbling from the side. But, you know, the other thing that killed me on that goal, because they had maybe it was Herrera, I can't remember the guy's name, but they had him like on his knees in the box and they defended it well, and then Jose Martinez just stood there and watched, you know.
And then the second goal is, you know, I think Elliott was way too passive. Just like either go for the ball, try and make a block or protect the near post, do something.
Yeah.
And he kind of just had nothing happen. I think he's dipped in form a little bit.
I think Jack hasn't had it. Yeah. I don't think Jack's had that great of a year, to be honest. And that's a tough one because you're moving in transition and there's a guy kind of floating behind. So Glesnes looked like he was playing that where he was just going to try to cut off the cutback if it came, and the cutback never came. But I think because Kai got cooked so bad, the center backs just weren't expecting him to get like abused the way he did. So Elliott just kind of had to abandon his guy and like just try to, I don't know, just come over and try to get in the way.
Yeah, it is kind of a no man's land for him there because Kai, I mean, That was kind of the play that was just like, all right, we got to get Kai off at halftime and figure it out from there.
Yeah, because originally I was looking at that. I'm like, why is Gleason so far off? And then I'm like, oh, they just both were like trying to scramble because they probably just did not expect like the left back to get totally killed like that. You know, it's as soon as I watch that replay, I'm like, something's got to be wrong with him because he never gets beat like that. So I didn't think too much of that. And then the first one we can analyze the shit out of it. Maybe I'll do a thing on Twitter, but the second one I was just like, whatever, you know. I don't know. From there, I mean, it got progressively more CONCACAF, I guess, towards the end. Like, the feed was shit. I kept seeing color bars every 5 seconds, the same way everybody else did.
It also didn't help that John Strong and Stu Holden, who, by the way, I could have sworn they've watched maybe one Union game this year.
Yeah.
And they're just going off of, like, things they saw in 2022. And they're on a monitor in Los Angeles, and they're just like, well, we don't exactly know what's going on. Oh, but here's confirmation. Like, halftime, it took them like 2 minutes to figure out who the subs were. Like,
exactly. Because I'm like sitting there thinking, I'm like, I see Harry all running around over there. Are they going to say anything about it? Yeah, that's a tough ass. And then they're at the mercy of the feed too, because of course the feed misses like three like near goal opportunities again. Like, it's just I don't need to go on another screed about like cutting away from games and like, you know, being a technical director and all this stuff. But, you know, it just the shit starts coming from the stands, and then you got the chant coming out of here. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't want to get into a whole big sidebar about the chant and all this stuff, because this isn't really like the time or place for all that. I mean, they won a great game.
I think we all have an understanding, like, yes, it's very bad and there should be punishment for it. And we should point it out. Like, I think I don't think it's a long kind of diatribe we need to have about it, because CONCACAF is trying, at least.
Well, right. They're going to handle it. And there's going to be some kind of retroactive punishment handed down here. You know, it'd be one thing if that happened for all, and there was no mechanisms in place and they didn't think there was anything wrong with it, and like it had just flown under the radar. If that would be one thing for every blue check mark on the planet to have to go to Twitter and say about how bad it is and whatever. It's like, I we know.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? I'm not like trying to downplay it or say like anybody can skate or whatever, but we're beyond the point where we need like, I don't like this term, but we don't need like virtue signaling when it comes to the chant, right? We've all established that it's bad. The leagues have established that it's bad. There's been a structure for punishment that's attached to it now, right? So it's just about them executing on that kind of stuff. I don't need like people just to feel like they're obligated to go onto Twitter every time they hear it and say, well, there it is again. Like, well, okay, we all heard it, we all saw it. Like the you know, hopefully the people who are in charge of policing it will do what they've set up to do.
Also, if the referee stops that game in what, the 88th, 89th minute, like that game's not getting restarted.
Well, no, and that's what I was going to ask, because I don't remember the technicalities off the top of my head, but when they hear it, they're supposed to stop the game now.
They issue the warning in stadium, which they did.
Right, because you hear the guy speaking in Spanish, and they played that twice.
It's just like I understand. It's.
Whether that was protocol or not, whether that was correct protocol or not for the ref to just keep playing, it felt like the right thing to do, because he was probably just thinking to himself, like, well, we only got 6 minutes in this thing. I should fucking get it over with and get out of here.
We only have 6 minutes. This thing is going to devolve into even more chaos if I stop the game. There's going to be things thrown on the field. The environment's going to get worse. And then you're going to have this 30 to 45-minute break just to play 5 minutes of a game that everybody kind of knows what the result
is. That's pretty much in the bag, right? To me, it felt like he was, de-escalating in a way, right? I mean, like, what's do to just let the game keep going and just let it roll? It's like, I probably, because I'm thinking, what's the alternative if they do stop it? If they do stop it, then it's more shit come down on the field. You know what I'm saying? Like, what does the alternative look like?
It becomes a lot worse. Also, I was convinced that Bedoya didn't go to the corner because there was things just flinging at a high rate.
Do you think that had something to do with it?
I don't know, because Ali's been through every battle possible in CONCACAF. But, like, I thought that for a second. I'm like, oh, is there just – or did, are just projectiles just flying left and right.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's interesting. I mean, well, regardless of whether that played a role or not, he would have got pelted. So,
right.
I don't know if it influenced his decision or not, but if he did go there, he probably would have got hit with some shit. Yeah, I don't know. I just it just got progressively. It's like what's the word that I'm looking for? Cumulatively, it got cumulatively more CONCACAF-y.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think that's the name of the podcast right there. So let me write that down right now. Cumulatively.
At least that's a word and not, was it dismantleization?
Dismantleization. Oh, man. Yeah, it was loopy. That's one of those where my wife was trying to go to bed and she's like, I'm getting in bed as soon as like midnight comes around. And I was like still wired from the game, which ended at like 12:01. So I was like laying there in bed for like a half hour staring at the ceiling like, oh, I'm not that tired, you know? So maybe I should have slept on the couch. Maybe for the next like CONCACAF after dark, I put my shit on the couch early. Maybe at halftime I go up and I get my stuff and I sleep on the couch like a like a scorned husband or something like that, you know? But
you're banned from watching too much CONCACAF.
No, you need a CONCACAF cool down period.
You do.
It's kind of what you, that's another good name for the episode.
I will notice that like Jim in the press conference last night, you could tell his adrenaline was still pumping. Like he's usually pretty cool, yeah. Calm and collected when he gets into the press conference, but you could tell his adrenaline was pumping, whether it was from, you know, being pissed off at the fans, the emotion from the getting through the semis, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
You could tell he still had a little extra juice running through his veins, and then, you know, totally understandable. But yeah, he was.
Well, could you imagine? Because they showed two shots of him, one after each goal, where, you know, the flag came up and he's got his hands up in the air. And like, can you just imagine what that feels like? Like you're a coach of the team or a player on that team, and like you know this is a goal. And you're probably just thinking in the back of your head, like, please do not like fuck me out of this goal, both of these goals, because you knew that they were legit. But just what that must be like mentally, like you're in Mexico, you got these fans going crazy. Like, you know, you just scored, but like the ref is, it's in the ref's hands. Like, it's gotta be like the worst feeling in the world.
I tweeted out last night that Bars doesn't have to buy a beer in Philadelphia ever again.
No. And it's funny too. And you know what? I got to be honest too. I didn't have a problem with either one of those flags going up just because that's kind of what they're taught to do.
Right.
Now, you know, yeah. And ultimately, like, what do we say when we had this discussion about, okay, was it Gibbons? Was it the show that Gibbons was on recently, where they had the VAR, non-VAR double review, whatever the hell it was. Like, ultimately, oh, it was Montreal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even though that was a shit show, like, okay, they got it right. Like, at the end of the day, the right call was made. And that's what happened in the Union game.
There have been two worse refereeing debacles involving Union games this year than that. I mean, they got their call right. I mean, the Cincinnati PK, whatever it may be, that was a whole debacle and stuff, and the Montreal thing. I mean, the right calls were ended up being made, but like, they handled that fairly easy compared
to what it's strange. I mean, it's like, is it strange to say that as CONCACAF-y as this game was at times, that it felt like it was not that CONCACAF-y in relative terms to like what it could have been or what we've seen before? It was reffed pretty consistently, you know, and like, I guess because the Union were on the front foot or led by aggregate, there's no rolling around from the League MX team. And the MLS teams don't do a lot of that shit to begin with. So other than Baizo and Carranza went down a couple of times, he did get hit on those, but it could have been worse in that regard, I guess is what I'm thinking, you know?
It could have been, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're like 40 something. That's kind of how long I like to go. Joe, you want to plug your, I don't think I've had you on since you started your Substack, right? Do you want to tell everybody about that?
Yeah, the conveniently named Union Soccer blog, which if you've been following along for God knows how many years now we've been doing this, started out as Union Soccer Talk, the video series, way back in the day with Sean Brace. And we have the very difficultly named Union Soccer podcast, which you can subscribe to wherever your podcast. But yeah.
Yeah, really, really going out on a limb with that. With that,
we are not the creative bunch. we are the degenerate, non-creative bunch. Myself, Sean Brace, and John Jansen. So yeah, soccer blog over on Substack. You can subscribe for free. We got a paid model over there as well. Yeah, just kind of doing what I've been doing for years, but now just employing myself so that no soccer websites go out of business and I'm screwed.
Well, there you go. And doesn't it feel good to be your own boss too? You know, so
it does.
That's all you can. That's all you can really ask for. Joe Tanzi, everybody. Thanks, man. It's always a pleasure. We'll get you on Crossing Broadcast too one of these days if you want to come on and talk like, you know, Pac-12, like women's field hockey after dark or something. You know, I know you're always watching something on TV. So.
I am one of the five people east of the Mississippi River with Pac-12 Network. Although I'm more of a basketball guy than a field hockey guy. But I like how all of the
like guys who do the union stuff have like a super random thing that they're like that they're into or that they also do like in addition to soccer. Like you're the guy who will stay up and watch like Hawaii versus Louisiana Tech on like Saturday at 1 a.m.
Absolutely.
DeGeorge has been to every high school within a 500-mile radius of Philadelphia, and I'm a soccer and MMA and college football guy who somehow ended up doing a Philly sports website where nobody seems to care about any of those sports, but you know,
they just care about arenas and Josh Harris.
Oh God, don't even get me. I need like a stiff drink after all that shit. I think I published my last arena story ever today. So
we know that's a lie.
Oh God. All right. Well, at least for the week. So anyway, it's always soccer in Philadelphia. Doop doop. See you next time.